Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaita Mritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashatyayinim Ambatvamanusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. Okay, we're on verse 8, chapter 10, verse 8. Aham sarvasya prabhavaha. Aham sarvasya prabhavaha matas sarvam pravartate matas sarvam pravartate iti matva pajante mam iti matva pajante mam buddha bhava samanvitaha buddha bhava samanvitaha aham sarvasya prabhavaha Mattaha sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante mam buddhaha bhava samanvitaha. The last, the bottom line, iti matva bhajante mam. Those who bhajante, they seek me. Those who seek me. Those who bhaj means like to seek. It also means to worship. You need something? Huh?
Just water.
Oh, water? You can go get some water. Itimatwa, having itimatwa means having known what? Aham sarvasya prabhavaha. I am the prabhavaha means I am the origin. I am the origin. I am the one from whom something is born. So aham sarvasya prabhavaha. I am the origin. I am the one from whom. Everything is born. I am the origin of all. Sarvasya. Sarvasya prabhavaha. Mataha sarvam pravartate. And everything, sarvam pravartate, everything is sustained, mataha, by me. I am the one from whom all is born, and I am the one by whom all is sustained. From whom all is sustained. And the material cause, we'll see. Mataha sarvam pravartate. Iti matva, having known this, aham sarvasya prabhavaha and mataha sarvam pravartate, iti having known this, bhajante mam buddhaha. Buddhaha means those who have knowledge, those who have self-knowledge. How Shankara says this, avagata paramartata tvaha, those people for whom the absolute truth is avagata, is known. Absolute paramartata tva is the absolute truth. Not this point, there's relative truth. Within samsara, within duality, there's relative truth. Like, for instance, science and math. But also just the knowledge that we gain through sense perception, even though in the end, you know, it goes into an infinite regress. You can never say something is absolutely true, but there's agreed upon knowledge. That's relative knowledge. The paramartika satyam is a knowledge that can never be negated. It's the knowledge that withstands all inquiry. You know, in the end, the whole, the reality of the dream resolves into the waker. The reality of this creation resolves into the self. So in the end, the paramartika, the absolute tattva, the absolute truth, is really Brahman, the self of the whole creation. That is the absolute truth of all things. And so here, those buddhaha, those who have this, who have that knowledge of the absolute, the absolute reality, that's called Buddhaha, those people. And then he says, Bhava Sambhitaha. Bhava Sambhitaha means their mind abides in that bhava. Here the bhava is vision. Their mind abides in that vision. So to understand that, if my mind is abiding in whatever I'm seeing, for instance, like right now, if I'm, say I'm practicing mindfulness, in a sense, and my mind is focused on this, then I'm totally present to this. My mind is present to this, my perception. What if my mind, its main point of abiding in spite of this perception, not negating the perception, but in the recognition of this as Ishwara. In the recognition of this, whatever you're perceiving as Ishwara, the consciousness, which is your being, is pervasive to this perception. So this perception is pervaded by the consciousness, which is me, which is Ishwara. Consciousness that I am can be identified with the body, the mind, sense organs, and then I have a subject-object relationship with this world, which on one level I do. As long as I'm a jiva here, an individual within this creation, I'm enjoying experiencing a subject-object relationship with the world through my sense organs and my mind. That's true. But there's also something else along with that to recognize. And that is that my being, the being which is the self, myself, is pervasive and the self of this entire perception. And so when I'm through my eyes, through my mind, my eyes, my sense organs, which are giving me this thought modification, instead of just the recognition of the thought modification, I recognize my own presence, which is pervasive to the thought modification. At the same time that I recognize that, that doesn't negate the existence of this jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, right? That is the having a subject-object relationship within this Bhagavan's creation. But there's something else to recognize, and that is that this creation is my being, and my being is pervasive to it and changeless to it also. And so that bhava, who abides in that vision of oneness or that vision of wholeness, the wholeness which has the self as its center, the wholeness is the self. Right? The wholeness, you can say, the mind is seeking, your mind is seeking wholeness or seeking ananda, seeking fullness in samsara, through the attainment of a desire or from doing something which is pleasurable to you, so that the mind can attain a state of relaxation, a state of calmness, which gives a sense of temporary sense of wholeness or relaxation, which is based upon the nature of that vritti, of that thought modification. The nature of the thought modification changes and gives different experiences. For instance, when the thought modification is pervaded by agitation, you know, or tension, then it is not pleasurable. Right? An agitated thought modification is not pleasurable, or a depressed thought modification is not pleasurable. A tense thought modification is not usually what we call pleasurable. You know, those are things that when those types of modifications, our thought modifications are there, emotionally laden thought modifications, we're usually trying to change them, right? To transform them into something which has more shanti, is more whole, that gives me more of a sense of completion, or more of a sense of that sense of where I might say, oh, this is how I want to be. That's what we, in a sense, that's what we mean by wholeness. This is how I want to be. This is how I feel. I feel full and complete. I feel like myself. And so we're we're trying always to balance our relationship with the world, to create vrittis which mimic the wholeness of myself, the natural well-being of myself. We're trying to create thought modifications which mirror that or mimic it in a way. But the problem is, those modifications, of course, are temporary. They're modifications that are generated in the mind by my relationship with the world, so to speak. Now, that's all I normally know, is that. But this bhava-sambhitaha, a buddhaha, somebody who has knowledge of the absolute reality, which is my own being, for that person, that knowledge, that self, is differentiated, is recognized as being pervasive to all of my experience, as being constant, the constant presence of myself, that is the very substance of all of my experience itself, being whole and complete and changeless without any possibility of wavering. And so when that wholeness, which isn't a wholeness that comes and goes, is recognized as the very substance, the very being of all of my experience, and I let that, the mind comes into relationship with that, in a sense, if we can talk that way, to let that self-experience, that self-evident experience of myself, comes much more to the forefront. Because my mind recognizes that, in fact, there is nothing more greater or more dear than the presence, the very natural, the nature of my own being. That there's nothing more dear to me. That doesn't really compete with anything. If I can say, well, doesn't it compete? Doesn't that presence of my being compete with the sukhavritti? Not really. The sukhavritti means a bliss vritti or happy vritti, a happy thought modification. It's not that we don't like happy thought modifications, you know, or happy, positive emotions. It's not to say anything against them. We prefer them over negative thought modifications. But what is more dear to me than the thought modification is the being, the person to whom the thought modification belongs. And that is, when that is recognized, then the mind, enjoying my own stable presence, experiences the world. And as the mind settles into that, this world that we experience, right, has me as its changeless self, and that becomes my natural, that recognition becomes natural to me because I get used to it. I get used to that viveka. As one understands that, then there's all kinds of repercussions or things that change in my own way of relating to the world as I understand that. As I understand the truth of it, means that it's a recognized reality for me. This bhava-sambhitaha means it is a recognized reality. It's not just a vision, a theoretical vision. It's a recognition. When that recognition is there, there's something very important that comes from that recognition. And that is, the presence of myself is there now, and there is nothing but now. What that means is, you never experience the future, and you never experience the past. You only experience a memory of the past and a projection of the future, which takes place in the present. Right? That's just the reality of samsara, that's the reality of time, that's the reality of my being. We can't experience past or future. And so if that means that, if you have a desire that in samsara, a desire means I need this in order to be happy. That's the desire template. I need this, I want this, so that I can be happy. That's the ajnani, that's the samsari desire template. I need this in order to be happy. And so now, the mind believing that goes through all types of trials and tribulations in order to accomplish that desire. Okay. Now, all along the way, from this moment to the next moment, to the next moment, all the way through to the accomplishment of the desire, I am there, timelessly. The full being that I am, is there timelessly. And so what that means is that every moment is the same as this moment. Every moment is the same as this moment from the perspective of reality, from the perspective of me. And I am the wholeness that I seek. And so why do I bother? Why do I bother? Because every moment is exactly like this moment. Because from the standpoint of view, there is no time. And so why not appreciate Ishvara? Why not appreciate and be with the reality that is here? Because every moment is the same from the standpoint of your being. For you, there is no time. For consciousness, there is no time. And so if we're talking about liberation, we're only talking about the mind's recognition of that fact, of the one who is most dear is the one who is free from time, who is the changeless self of every moment. And the moment only, we're only talking about samsara. Time belongs to samsara. Time belongs to duality. I'm the self of time. I'm the changeless presence of time. And so for the one who has that knowledge, you know, that samvita, those people, he says, you know, those people gain me. Those people gain me, having recognized that I, which is the self that I am the self. I am the self of the whole creation. I'm the source of the entire creation. I'm the being of the prabhava, means I'm the origination. I am the clay of the pot. I am the substance. I am that from which this whole creation comes. I am the self, the one who is there as the very substance of the entire creation. Right? And so there is no experience, really, that is away from me or other than me. And so the ajnanam, the ignorance, belongs to the mind that is out here within duality trying to find that substance, the being of what is actually here, to trying to find it, to find the ananda, to find the wholeness, to find, you know, that stability within the names and forms that by them, but that themselves only have for their being me. And so this is the viveka that's necessary. So for a person who recognizes that, who knows that, who's that bhava means they see that, not see it as an object. They're awake to that. It is those people that gain me, that attain me. And so now he says more. Machitta, machitta, madgata pranaha, machitta, madgata pranaha, bodhayanta parasparam. Bodhayanta parasparam katayantas jamam nityam katayantas jamam nityam tushyanti cha ramanti cha tushyanti cha ramanti cha machittaha madgata pranaha bodhayantaha parasparam katayantas cha mam nityam tushyanti cha ramanti cha. He says, talking again about those people who have knowledge, or the mumukshus, those who are the jnanis, those who have knowledge, or the jignasus, those who are seeking to know, the mumukshus, machittaha, those people whose chitta, whose mind is in me. Means I am the one whom they love. I am the one who they seek. The mind is centered on me. On me is Ishwara, the Lord, the One, the Paramatma. Matchitaha, mad gata pranaha. So I am the object of interest. I am the object of their desire, matchitaha. And I am mad gata pranaha. How Swamiji takes this is really nice. He says, I am my life, my prana, my life revolves, the one whose life revolves around me. The whole life is revolving around me. For jnani or for jignasu, shravana, manana, nididhyasana, and the world is your sadhana, right? There's shravana, but what's what we do? Shravana, manana, nididhyasana means you expose yourself to this teaching. We'll see what else in here too. You expose yourself to this teaching and you gain antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, a mind that abides in this teaching through karma yoga, etc. And so that's what I'm doing in this life is really gaining nishta, is really gaining this knowledge and gaining a mind that is capable of abiding in this knowledge. Right? Not even a mind that is capable. I'm gaining knowledge and I'm giving my mind the time it needs to mature into this knowledge. So what I'm doing in this life is gaining knowledge. That's all. That's what I do. You know, the whole life, everything I'm doing, all, it's not that I don't have many, many interactions and this job and that job and this job and that, and we're doing things, all these relationships, all the things, life. But what is the life for? Is for gaining nishta in this knowledge, you know. And you can't make that up. You can't pretend that. You're just talking about what is natural. What is natural to a mumukshu, a jignasu? For that person, what is foremost to the mind is self-knowledge, and what is foremost to the life is self-knowledge. So everything is sadhana. You know, everything is sadhana. The shravana, manana, nididhyasana, as well as your day-to-day. One, the sadhana is for antakarana shuddhi, for purity of mind. The other sadhana is for actually understanding, exposing yourself to the teaching, to the logic, to the inquiry, to the questioning. That's the manana. And exposing yourself, doing, practicing nididhyasana, contemplation, so that you can actually get to know yourself. What you see at the time of teaching, you let your mind sit with, recognize, give the mind time to develop a relationship with yourself, in a sense, because all of its time has been spent previous to knowledge, gaining a relationship with samsara. Right? It's a relationship within duality rather than a relationship, in a sense, you know, with your own being. So your own being has been, who you are has been totally superimposed upon your body, mind, sense organs, as though you are this. That's the reality for a samsari, as I, my being, is totally, it's a mutual superimposition where I become the body, mind, sense organs and the body, mind, sense organs become the conscious being. You know, and so this conscious being in the form of the body, mind, sense organs, this jiva complex, comes into relationship more and more and more with samsara. In other words, I'm getting more and more held by the net of samsara, because that is my reality for a mind that doesn't have knowledge. But for a mind that gains knowledge, then that mind coming in, differentiating the conscious being that you are from all of its activity, and recognizing that satya-mitya relationship where the mind and body, sense organs, world in fact is totally dependent on me for its being, but I am its being. But I am also free from all of it, in that I'm not subject to any kind of change. And so the mind, having come awake to that, having differentiated me from all of these experiences, then comes into relationship with me, recognizing that stable, changeless self in reference to every experience that I have. There is no experience, positive or negative, that doesn't have me for itself. It's not like, for somebody who has knowledge, you can't say, oh, I had this. this terrible emotion, you know, and, you know, and when I had that terrible emotion, you know, I don't know where myself went. And you have to say, no, that's not quite right. That's not quite right. You have to recognize that no matter what the emotion, what the situation, what is going on, the complexity of it, the mess of it, all of the samsara that's capable of, you are right there in the very center of it, totally untouched. It never changes in any way. And so the more that you're being, that differentiation and relationship on the part of the mind is there, what happens is that no matter what the experience, as good or bad that it might be, as positive or negative that the experience may be, you are untouched by it. That doesn't mean it's a nice experience, but you are the self of that experience. And no experience can cover you or make you lose yourself. That's why some time has to be taken for the mind to really get to know, to recognize the stability of its own being, right? It's like the pot really has to work for a while to discover that it's clay, and that the clay, nothing ever happens. My mind has to work for a while to do shravana, manana, nitta dhyasana, sit with others, sit with myself, you know, to really wake up to the fact that I am free. Completely. Nobody can do anything about it. I can't even do anything about it. I can't make myself, can't change it. I can't change that freedom. That's what makes freedom freedom. There's nothing you can do about it. And you can't make it better. That's a great thing also for us super achievers, you know, the overachievers. They always have the burden of trying to make things a little bit more perfect. I suppose you can always throughout your life, you know, work on your body mind, and you can always go on learning, always. That is endless, you know, improving in this way or that way, you know, but that's not true for yourself. You cannot improve it. You can't make it worse. You can't change it. It is whole and complete and free from time, and that's where the freedom lies. You know, that's where the freedom lies. And so, and that is the very truth of the body, mind, sense organs. And so that recognition is a tremendous thing. So for a jnani, of course, it's true their mind always is always centered on me, because there's no place I am not, honestly. And the same for the jignasu, but there's desire to know there, desire to understand. And so through the desire to know, the mind is always centered on me. Jignasu is one who desires to know. It's like a mumukshu, one who desires liberation. This is a Sanskrit term. It's a desiderative. Like if I say jignasu, what that means, jnanam ichati, or one who desires knowledge, is a jignasu. Mumukshu is moksham ichati, one who desires liberation. So jignasu, mumukshu. A mumukshu, one who desires liberation, the teacher will convert that desire for freedom, liberation, into the desire for knowledge. Because in fact, you already are free. And so then it's a matter of recognizing the truth of that, knowing the truth of that. And so for the jnani means the one who has knowledge. The one who has knowledge, for that person, that machitta is really that where the mind is always in me, is natural, because there is nothing but me. There's no place that you can look that is not the self, that is not Ishvara. So for a jnani, that's always the truth. For a jignasu, a seeker, one who desires knowledge, that also is always the truth, because what is single, what is on the jignasu's mind is that desire to know me, the desire to know the self. And so they also, everything that they're doing is centered on me. So machitta goes either way, to the jnani or to the jignasu. And then the same Mudgata Pranaha, one whose whole life revolves around the self. For a jnani, everything revolves around the self because there's nothing but the self. Everything is Ishvara. For the jignasu, everything, the whole life revolves around the self in terms of sadhana, karma yoga, exposure to shravana, manana, nididhyasana, to the teaching. That is what makes a person's life. Mm-hmm. Then he says, also, bodhiyantaha parasparam. What else do they do besides, you know, having the life, the mind centered on me, the life centered on me? They teach each other, bodhiyantaha. They teach each other, parasparam, mutually. So this teaching tradition, you know, is an important part of the sadhana. Because if you discuss with another person, if you teach another person, you also gain clarity, you know. It's not at all about trying to become a guru or take this type of, take a role. It's not about taking a role. It's very natural, like in the ashram when we were at Sandipani in India all those years, you know, the students were always teaching each other. One student, even whether it be in Sanskrit or if Swamiji had been talking about something, and then one student was ahead in some way or another, other students would gather around and they would be discussing back and forth all of the time and helping each other in that way. And you find that any time you teach, whether it's teaching Sanskrit or physics, or it doesn't matter what you're teaching, when you're teaching, your own vagueness becomes clear. And also Bhagavan gives you a little push there also in helping your clarity. And so teaching, writing, satsang with each other, passing on this knowledge in one way or another, out of love for this teaching and out of the love for that sadhana, that sharing, is something which helps to give you nishtha. If you teach, it becomes your own. If you teach and you run into a boulder, then if you're a serious person when you know about what you're inquiring into, and you run into, you know, what we call these boulders where all of a sudden I don't know what that is. That's what it is. You don't know what it is. So this is something to inquire into. Now, say you're teaching, and all of a sudden somebody asks you a question and kind of look at it, like, I don't know what that is. Well, that's right. You don't know what it is. So this is a thing for inquiry. And so with that type of a spirit, if you're teaching and sharing with each other, it's a very, very positive thing. You know, within this tradition, it's very positive. You have to just be careful because of the things that have kind of come over in this modern era, even in India. The whole idea of a guru and all of that has so much stuff projected on it. Instead of it being just...
What happened?
It's had so much projected on it. On these words, misunderstood words. Misunderstood words like guru and enlightened being. These kind of things. There's a lot of misunderstanding, you know, that takes away the beauty of it, of what it is. The very simple, down-to-earth, wonderful beauty of this knowledge and what it means to share it, you know. Because there's a lot of guru ego floating around, and it is harmful. It's not just harmful to the students, it's harmful to the students who start teaching and think they're supposed to be gurus. It's harmful all the way around. But what is actually meant there is something very profound and very beautiful, and has to do with sharing this knowledge with each other for the sake of clarity. Any type of teaching helps bring clarity, unless you're not really honoring and respectful to the knowledge, which means to for you too to remove ignorance. Teacher and student need to remove ignorance. If there's ignorance, there is ignorance that you just go get, find your own teacher, find your teacher, call, ask Swamiji or somebody. There's, you know, it's so simple. But so here, that bodhiyantaha parasparam, that just mutually sharing, mutually teaching each other this knowledge, or passing it on. If you're a senior student, you pass it on to a junior student, you know, because you can help, and it helps you as much as it helps that student. Then also, katayantascha mam nityam. Always katayanti means to tell stories. We're talking about with each other where you are recognizing things about Ishvara. So Bhagavan says, you know, you should be noticing beautiful things about me. You should be, you know, noticing what the wonders of this creation, the wonders of and glories of Ishvara, and be talking about those things, sharing those things with each other. The teaching is really giving this knowledge and helping to bring about clarity. Katyanta means, you know, you should be always just appreciating the wonders of Ishvara. There is nothing out. I mean, there every wonder that there is in the world is Ishvara. And so noticing the wonder of this creation as Ishvara and talking about that, you should always be doing that, he says. And so nitya means all the time, that bodhiyantaha, that machittaha nityam. This is what you should be doing with your life. You should be, in your mind, think about me, have your life be centered on me, be teaching each other about me, praising me, you know, talking about what you see, talking about the glories of Ishvara. And then for those people, such people, tushanti, those people are satisfied. Tush means to feel satisfied, to feel whole and complete. And ramanti means the ananda, the joy of the mind in that process. There's the tushanti, it's just the natural wholeness and fullness that a person experiences in that type of life. And the ramanti is the ananda, the reveling. Because really the source of any moment of joy that we think that we're gaining through the fulfillment of a desire, that fulfillment of a desire, really all it is doing is giving me a shantavritti. It's giving me a clean mirror that reflects the sun. And so in that clean, peaceful mirror, at the moment that a desire is fulfilled, the sun shines brightly in that mirror. And so the natural, very simple, unassuming ananda of myself that is present as the very self of every vritti, of every thought modification, when there's a shanta vritti, it's as though that simple ananda lights up the mind in a particular way that we call the gradiated versions of happiness. I'm happy, happier, happiest, you know. There's so many grades of happiness, or so many grades of love, so many grades of compassion, of joy, these positive emotions. It's gradiated, you know, and there's subtle differences to all of these things because there's subtle differences in the quality of the mind. But all of those states of mind enjoy a level of shanti that allows for kind of a resonance, a natural resonance with your own nature. And so, what about the one who has recognized that the source of the ananda which the mind enjoys is myself? Then that mind no longer wants to go on some circuitous route of let me do this and this and this and this and this and this and ward off this obstacle and this obstacle and this obstacle and this obstacle and go through all of that stress so that I can fulfill this desire, so that I can have a shantavritti, so that I can enjoy a moment of reveling. Instead, the mind just simply revels in the self, which is the source, The reason an Ajnani does not do that is because they believe that the source of the ananda is out there in that object. And so if I could just have that object, then I would revel. Right? But the Jnani knows that isn't so, and also knows what is so. You have to know both. The mumukshu knows that isn't so, but they don't know what is so. That's why you have that dark night of the soul. You know, you realize, you know, this doesn't work. And all it does is give these little drops of happiness that drip away. So where is this happiness? That's the mumukshu. They know this doesn't work. But the jnani knows, yeah, it doesn't work. Of course it doesn't work. Because the source of the ananda isn't here. The source of the ananda is my own being, you know, which reflects in the mind in a positive way whenever the mind is peaceful. But really, for a jnani, the mind just then enjoys the ananda of myself, which is never away from it at all, which is its very self, and revels in that. You know, so the mind spends its time reveling in that reality. And reveling in that reality, it feels satisfied because there's nothing, it's not doing anything that causes it to feel divorced from the self, because everything it sees is the self. See what I mean? And so that's why they use this tushanti, your self is naturally whole and complete. When we were doing the meditation, and I said, you know, you have to spend a little time just to see who you are, what you are like, not the different thoughts and emotions that are passing through, because those are experiences that come and go. They're like clouds, just coming and going, they're passing through. But what are you like, the one who's present to all of that? What is your nature? You know, what words, if you were to use words to describe yourself, what would those words be? You know, it could be like, you know, I'm non-judgmental, not wanting, I'm whole, I'm strong. There's an incredible strength there because nothing can move me or change me. You have to, these words, all the words are samsara words. But you're using these relative words to point to, even though they're inadequate, you know what they mean. You know what you mean by them, because they're landing upon your own being. And then something like that, one really beautiful contemplation is that, are you the most dear? Is there anything more, what we call priya, is there anything more beloved or more dear to you than this? Than your own being. When you contemplate on that, then you'll understand why they use the word ananda for the self. Because there is nothing more. There's nothing that compares to you in any way. It's even the greatest anandavritti, you would never choose it over yourself. And so what is that? What is that dearness or that ananda? And I'd say that that's maybe one of the most important realizations. Because people can look at, of course I'm only talking about myself, but my own process. But people can look at like awareness, words like awareness or consciousness, and have a sense that is not, they're not talking about me. There's an abstractness to when you say consciousness or awareness that seems almost like space or something. It seems neutral, you know, not something that you would call ananda. And so that recognition of this being my very self, and that there is nothing more dear, that when I'm talking about awareness, it's not an abstract, theoretical term. It's a very simple term that's pointing to my own nature. You know, I am conscious, awareful being. These are just words, point. But to understand what those words are pointing at, you have to look at where the finger's pointing, so to speak, what the word is pointing at. What is the word awareness pointing at in terms of your own self-experience? And why do they say that this me, this awareness that is me, is ananda? What do they mean by ananda? Why do they say that it is the most dear, that the awareness is the beloved? You know, in the Sufi poets, and in Rumi, and all of the in Hindu, you know, poets, well, and even in St. John of the Cross and the mystics, they'll point to that as self really as the beloved. What is beloved about it? Why do they say this word? Why do they say ananda? That has to be, you have to meditate on that. See, and you have to meditate like this. Why is that awareness called, you know, out there, called the beloved? No, it's, why am I? Why is this being, the me, you know, the one who is there illumining the thoughts, this presence, this me, why is it called, why am I called the beloved or the most dear? Why does the Murti, Shivamurti, or the Dakshinamurti, who's, you know, the little boy says, Mommy, why is Shiva meditating? The Murti, the form of Shiva in the temple. Why is Shiva meditating? Why is the Lord meditating? And then Shiva's got this beautiful half smile, you know, he's meditating. Who's he meditating on? You know? Why that beautiful half smile? Why do all the Murtis, all the deities in the temples have this beautiful, very gentle half smile?
Mm-hmm.
That image of the Murti. Murti means the form of the Lord in the temple. That image is a very precise and described, minutely described in the Shastra when they make these, you know, in the Shastra that tells how to make these Murtis. That smile and the eyes, all this very specifically described. And when you look at the Murti, and sometimes what you can do is in contemplation, just imagine taking on that form, that half smile, and you're, you know, just gently, very gently closing your eyes and having that half smile, and see how it evokes the ananda or the wholeness or the fullness of yourself. And you can see what that image itself is pointing to, just like the words point, that image points to your own nature. And so those type of contemplations are important, because you have to bring the ananda together with your being to understand what they mean by the word. We don't want to just be dry old akasha space awareness. You are just like space.
Free.
Free like space. If you say free like space, that's fine, but the freedom has to resolve into the wholeness of yourself. That's the ananda, that's the freedom, you know, where the mind has discovered where the ananda is. Mm-hmm. It no longer has to be running out here in samsara trying to find it. It's discovered it, you know. And then that solves the problem, even though for some good length of time, depending on at what level of maturity we actually come to this knowledge. You know, you come to this knowledge when you do. That's a tremendous punya, it's a tremendous blessing. Whether you come to this knowledge when the mind has, you've kind of painstakingly gone through Dharma and so many different things to come to mind, the knowledge with a very mature mind, like somebody like Ramana, or you come to this knowledge with a less mature mind, mature enough to be a mumukshu, but less mature than somebody like Ramana. That just means that the mind, in the light of knowledge, is going through that maturation process. Where a mind, somebody like Ramana, his mind has gone through a tremendous maturation process before knowledge, before coming to knowledge. In either case, you have to come to knowledge. If you come to knowledge where the mind needs to still mature, then if you have a proper understanding, then that's a tremendous blessing, because your mind is allowed to grow and mature, you know, in the light of your knowledge. You don't have to be all alone in samsara as it's, you know, going through that maturing process. It's maturing in the light of knowledge. If you understand that process, then you can be a great very patient and great aid to your mind, you know, just like you would to your child. You know, as your child is growing up and maturing, you know, you get to be a mother from its babyhood, you know, and then you just let it mature. It's the same with whatever you come to this knowledge, whatever level of maturity the mind is, it has significant maturity already, or you wouldn't have no interest in this knowledge whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It would just be a non-issue. Mm-hmm. And it would be like, oh my God, she's going to one of those classes.
But I like it.
The mind has the maturity and the punya and the grace to expose oneself to this teaching is a great thing. And then in the light of this teaching, it goes through that process of maturing. But you have to understand what that is. Otherwise, this Vedanta stick comes out. You should be like this, and you should be like that. If you have this knowledge, then you should be like this, and you should be like that. So students used to call it the Vedanta stick. Yeah, but that's ignorance, really. It just means that you haven't understood. You know, so this knowledge has to totally, you know, integrate into the person that is there. Help the mind that is there, the person that is there, so that mind can be allowed to grow and to become big. You know? Swamiji once said, your mind, in the end, your heart has to be as big as Ishwara. Mm. You know, because Ishwara accommodates everything. Mm-hmm. And also, another good meditation is, if you notice, you know, the nature of yourself, when you're just focusing and getting to just know yourself, you're completely accepting, completely non-judgmental, just like the sun is totally accepting and non-judgmental. It just illumines everything. It doesn't say, I'm only going to illumine you and not you. Mm-hmm. Like that, your being illumines all things. Your being, in fact, it illumines and is the self of the entire creation. You know? Mm-hmm. And so, it's not about rejection, it's about helping and dharma, you know. Just like with your child, it's not about rejecting, it's about dharma, it's about teaching, it's about helping. You know? And so it's the same for us, it's about dharma, it's about helping, it's about shining your knowledge on your mind and on the situation in a way that is helpful. And Swamiji's often said like that. He only wants to be helpful. There's not another agenda there. Mm-hmm. And that's the agenda that we need internally also. Mm-hmm. It's easy to understand that, though we may not live up to it, but it's easy to understand that in reference to the world. The agenda to be helpful, yeah, I would like to be that. We just be helpful. It has to be turned inward. Also, yes. Let me be helpful to my mind in that process of maturing. And so in this verse, that's what he's talking about. The whole life is really about being helpful to them and honoring them and that knowledge. Okay. All right, let's stop there. Thank you. Om Purnamidam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishite Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om. Christmas socks.
You know, there's so many pursuits in life, you know, and the Vedanta is like one of the pursuits. Why do they say that is like the king of pursuits, or what makes it different than the others that would make life valuable to you, kind of thing? You know?
Because all of the other pursuits in life really exist within samsara, and so in the end they don't really give you what you're seeking. Because you're seeking something that is whole and complete, and so then you can relax in that reality. So the only thing that gives that is knowledge, really. Because that result is not attainable within samsara. Now, that doesn't mean that you need to reject all of your pursuits within samsara. It just means that you shouldn't burden them with something that they can't give you, you know. It's not about not doing. It's about understanding the limitations of the results of what you're doing. And so the only thing that's going to give you a result that is free from time, right, is knowledge of yourself. Or the only thing that is going to give you ananda is ananda itself, you know. Not kind of a shadow state. In other words, a state of mind, you know, that is fleeting. That's what we gain in samsara. We gain fleeting states of mind. Because that's the nature of the mind. If the mind wasn't fleeting, we'd be in trouble. You know, the mind is continually changing. But if we haven't differentiated the wholeness, which is steady and full and is not changing, and is the very self of that mind, if we haven't made that differentiation, then we're totally dependent upon the state of mind. And the state of mind is fleeting by nature. And so all of your pursuits, when no matter whether it's a big pursuit or a little pursuit, you know, if you're superimposing, you know, ananda, you know, wholeness or fullness onto that given accomplishment, you will continually be disappointed.
Guaranteed.
Even though you may gain the objects, you won't gain what you had hoped to gain from the situation.
Yeah. You won't gain liberation.
What?
You won't gain liberation.
You won't gain liberation. You won't gain a state of lasting ananda. Even whether it's in a marriage or a family or a job, it really doesn't make any difference. And it's not to say that those things aren't good in and of themselves, but if you load on it an attainment of lasting well-being, or now what is to be done has been done.
Yeah.
What is to be accomplished has been accomplished.
I get the prize then.
And you realize that you have all of the things, but you don't have the prize. And you have it all, but you don't have what all that all was supposed to give. And that's what is continually experienced. And so, you know, what you're looking for is actually, you know, timeless. And you're looking for it in a time-bound world. And so that type of clarity has to... You have to understand that it's... The world is not being negated here, you know. This is Ishvara. It's only when you load it devote onto it what it is not, and then run around trying to get it. Mm. You know, it's like beating your head against the wall. It's total disappointment. If you don't load it, you know, with what it doesn't have, then it's something that's an incredible. And there's a lot of suffering in the world by very nature. Its body is going to get sick and die.
Yeah.
You know? Your sense organs are going to fail. You will lose loved ones.
Yeah.
Even no matter how dharmic you are.
Yeah.
You know, because that's the nature of the world. You know, but if you're not loading onto it what it can't provide you, then you can appreciate the incredible what this is. That there is even is a world. Even that there is a creation is something totally mind blowing. In fact, in one when the Chandogya Upanishad, it says something like, in one verse it says something like, if you think about this too much, your head will explode. That's like the way it says.
Yeah, yeah,
it's so incredible. I know.
This is a kind of a pedestrian question, I think, but I have to ask it anyway. I don't know Swamiji, but does he get pissed? Does he get angry at himself or at people? Does that ever happen?
I'd say in the, 40 years or so I've known him?
Four?
40.
40, yeah.
Maybe two or three times I've seen something pass through.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Because he's so objective. You know, he's probably, when he was a young man, he probably wasn't that way. Mm-hmm. But he is now.
Mm-hmm. So how do you explain that? I mean,
because it's maturity. You know, the mind takes however long it takes to really understand. To really understand what you understand. So you understand it, and then you really understand it. And then you say, oh my gosh, that's what they meant. You know? So levels upon, and not that you were wrong before.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that there's an incredible layer upon layer upon layer of assimilation and of the mind's owning up what it knows. You know, like the emotional mind owning up what the buddhi knows.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole process of assimilation that goes on, and it brings about, every moment of assimilation brings about more vairagya.
But you know, you see that attained in Swamiji, but you know, he's a far superior type of mind, has a far superior type of mind than my little old mind.
Well, in that way, Swamiji is not a very good role model. You know why? Because he is, we could say, you know, like people have different footprints, like there's an Einstein and a Jung, and there's some people that are like Shrestha Purushas, means they're beings that have a big mission in this world. And Swamiji has a huge, huge footprint. And he also has lots of what we call vibhutis, just like, for instance, tremendous memory, beautiful singing voice, naturally kind of outgoing and loving personality, even if he was an agnani, you know.
Good features.
Very, very, very handsome, incredibly, especially when he was a young man.
I'm just
amazing. So he, and energy, unbelievable energy. But this is his upadhi, you know.
Yeah. Well,
and so. It says the body he was born with and the karma.
So, you know, I have my qualities are much less than that. I mean, I'm just ordinary, you know.
Yeah,
ordinary.
You're just an ordinary guy.
Yeah.
But you're not just an ordinary self. Yeah, and so your footprint isn't as big. So I think actually sometimes I think that some of Swamiji's students have a problem because. Can have a problem.
Yeah, we can match up to him, right?
They can't match up to him in terms of the footprint.
Yeah.
And the incredible amount of knowledge he has and the incredible memory and teaching capacity. And so then these type of what we call vibhutis get equated with knowledge, and they can get equated with knowledge. And so here this little teacher over here has a little tiny footprint, you know, and can't sing.
Not handsome.
Yeah, he's stocky. One eye doesn't work so good.
But if you understand that, that's like, that won't be an issue.
Yeah, but still, like you say, it's a hard role model because, you know, if he only can kind of like suffer from anger two or three times in 40 years. You know, that's a mind that...
You know, in some... So, what I was saying, in some ways, he's not a good role model because of the big footprint. Huge footprint.
Can you give a more modest example?
But in other ways, being with Swamiji has... And I feel, for me personally, has taught me so, so much because you get to be with someone and live life with somebody who consistently takes you fresh each moment, you know, and that you internalize that, just like if in a therapeutic relationship you'll internalize your therapist because they're trained, really they know how to be consistent.
So then the achievement of freedom and that steadiness of mind with one's own being, it's not that you have to be able to climb Mount Everest. I mean, you can just go to the bazaar and still get there, right? I mean, that's what it seems like when you think of
there's nowhere to get. There's something to know.
Yeah, but I mean, to know it that well, you need the skills of Swamiji, you know.
No, you don't.
Okay, tell me.
You don't need to have a great memory. You don't have to have a great singing voice. You do have to have a desire for this knowledge, and you have to be patient, and you have to know how, you have to learn, and it takes as long as it does. That's all. You know, you don't have to be a genius, but you have to have viveka. You know, if you don't have viveka, that ability to discriminate, then you can't know in this lifetime. That's because your mind's not available. You know, or if you don't have mumukshutvam, you won't know in this lifetime because your mind doesn't want to know. You know, or if it's impaired, it's not able to discriminate, not able to listen. But if you're able to listen, you're able to discriminate, you have the desire. If you don't have a desire, then you can't keep your mind focused. We focus on what we desire. And so you have to have a desire for knowledge, a desire for understanding. And we don't have to be a genius at all. You just have to be you. You know, but there's all kinds of, we come with so much baggage, you know, like emotional problems of self-acceptance and this not being treated well as a child. There's all kinds of things that we then have to learn the different ways of holding those parts of ourselves so that they can grow and become free and join back with me, you know, instead of being like split off, hurt parts, and that requires some skill. That's why so much psychology, even with Swamiji, has integrated so much psychology into this teaching, because on the level of antakarana shuddhi, you know, that purity of mind, there needs to be the methods for resolving these problems are necessary and helpful. Yeah. You know?
Rana,
go ahead.
Would you say that?
Go ahead.
This is a quick question.
Okay.
I sometimes get the impression that Swamiji is on the same level as Shankara, but you know, like 800 years later, or whatever it is, 1200 years later. Like, is he big as?
We can say that in the sense that his mission, what his footprint is. Is similar to what Shankara did, which was to go through the whole of India and reignite and enliven the teaching in terms of what he did. And Shankara, and you know, it's a small band of disciples really move throughout India and reestablish that whole Vedic Sampradaya teaching methodology. So Shankara is noted for that. Mm-hmm. Swamiji's doing that same thing in a very big way.
Yeah.
You know, and so people will say, oh, Swamiji's a modern-day Shankara. But that's what they're talking about.
They are saying that.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people say that. Just because there is something...
Well, it's factual, too. It's not, it's not praise. I mean...
It is factual. It is factual in the sense Shankara did this, and now Swamiji's doing it, too. He obviously is doing it. There might be other people that are also doing something like that. But he is doing that in a very big way.
Marina, I might have mentioned this, but I've been with, you know, a few different teachers, and I spent these 2 weeks with Swamiji in Salisbury last year, and I've had a fair amount of pain almost, you know, for years, and I had no pain for the 2 weeks I was there, which was just strange and not, you know, noticeable. I've never had it again. It came back after 2 weeks, you know, but while there with him, it was gone.
Yeah, and the knowledge is so absorbing too. It takes the mind to a different place. Stop on that note.
Yeah, good. We have great classes here.
Are you ready to stop?
Yeah.